Welcome to Decades, a podcast series about the history of Ireland and the European Union, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. Today's episode is part one of a conversation with Professor Gary Murphy of DCU. Here, Gary talks about the series of events that culminated in Ireland joining the European Economic Community in 1973. I began by asking him to give us a sketch of what Ireland was like in the 1950s, long before the enormous economic and social changes that were to come. Professor Gary Murphy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Ian.
So this podcast series is about 50 years of Irish membership in the European Union and previously the European Economic Community, or EEC. But given your expertise, I'd like to talk about the years going back even before 1973, when Ireland joined. So going back to even the 1960s and the 1950s. Do you want to talk about what were conditions like in Ireland in the 1950s, say, compared to the rest of Western Europe?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a great pleasure to be with you and the listeners, and I'm happy to discuss a topic I've been interested in a very long time. I did my PhD in the middle of the 1990s, and so a long time ago, and on this topic, really, on Ireland and Europe in the immediate post-war era. Ireland was a poor agricultural country on the European periphery. It had been neutral during the Second World War, but comes out of the war in a much poorer place in many ways than those countries which were ravaged and torn by war. An extraordinary story in one way of a policy failure. But the 1950s in Ireland are a poor, dismal decade, really, I'm afraid to say. To give you just one example, 600,000 people, we estimate, left the Irish state in the 1950s. 60,000 a year emigrated. Most of them emigrated to Britain. Some more adventurous souls went west to the United States and Canada. And an even more adventurous bunch would have went to Australia and New Zealand. But it's an extraordinary story of what I would describe as policy failure. There's very little indigenous industry. What industry there is protected. There are protective tariffs on exports coming into the country. The result of that is that foreign goods are very expensive. Irish goods simply aren't as well made. So if you look at things like footwear, textiles, which there was industry, protected industry, the quality isn't simply as good because the competition isn't there. And that's not some right-wing sort of rant about free competition, but free trade becomes very important for policymakers in the late 1950s when there was a realization that, you know, we simply cannot go on living in a kind of a protected economic environment in which, you know, can't sustain the people, and those people who can sustain are then getting on the boat to England or getting on the plane. Aer Lingus comes into operation in Ireland in the early 1960s, but they're emigrating. Politically, it's a very interesting time. Fianna Fáil lose power in 1948 for the first time in 16 years. This comes as a great shock to De Valera in particular, Éamon De Valera, Taoiseach leader of Fianna Fáil, the great sort of revolutionary of the 1916 to 1923 era of Irish Revolution, War of Independence, the Civil War, although that's a very bad moment personally for him, and he's kind of ignored by both sides. But as the sort of architect of our modern Ireland, as he would have seen himself, he's a strangely aloof figure in the 1950s. He is unaware, really, of the difficulties most normal people have living their lives, even what you might call lower middle class property people, you know, in the professions. The work simply isn't there, and won't be there if the stagnation continues. But they lose office in 48, an inter-party government, a kind of a grand coalition of a hodgepodge of different parties comes in. That's turfed out in 51, Fianna Fáil are back in, they're back out in 54, and they're back in 57. And then 1959, De Valera, who at this stage is close to 80, runs for the presidency and is replaced by Sean Lamass, younger. He fought in the 1916 Rising as a 16-year-old, so he's in his he's in his mid to late 50s. Not a young man, but he's very energetic, and with a number of civil servants, and a sort of a general agreement amongst the what I would describe as the sort of the wider economic sphere. So I'm talking about farmers groups, employers groups, trade unions to a lesser extent. There's a big debate, and we can talk about this in a minute, in the 1970s at the referendum, the 72 referendum on the trade unions. But in the early late 50s, early 60s, the union groups, I mean, yeah, they want to represent their members, but the problem is they're really dwindling because of the of unemployment. So unemployment is running at about 12 to 15% during the decade. The emigration, as I said, is just colossal. Young people are leaving in their droves. And I mean, culturally, Ireland is parochial. It's inward looking. And it's also a time, of course, where particularly into the 1960s, where you have younger people getting more interested in things, you know, music and the like. So in that context, Ireland is a really pretty dismal decade in the 50s, but the efforts to join the EEC and EFTA in the late 1950s does change the dynamic.
Right. Okay, so that's a great introduction to this topic. So this, and it brings us to the, I guess it's the first application to join. And I believe Ireland, they joined the application that had been made. They joined alongside the United Kingdom, the application to join the EEC. I believe it was in 1961. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's late July of 61. So what happens is in the late 1950s, there's a new secretary of the Department of Finance from 1956, a young man called T.K. Whittaker, Ken Whittaker, as he was known. Relatively conservative in his early years. He'd written the 1952 budget, commonly seen as the most the harshest budget in the history of the state, certainly up until the crash of post-2008. But by the late 1950s, when he's the top civil servant in the country, his view is, you know, Ireland will just stagnate unless we join one of these trading groups. So there are two. There's the EEC, European Economic Community, but there's also EFTA, the European Free Trade Area. Some of the Scandinavian countries, Portugal, and so we look at both of them. The British decide that the EEC is where they want to be. There's obviously a big discussion in Britain, the Harold Macmillan government, and Ireland and Britain apply separately. And the Irish application goes in a day earlier, I think on the 31st of July 61, which is to show internal public opinion that, you know, we're not tied at the hip to the British application, but in reality, we are. And why is that? It's because 85% of Irish exports in the 1950s and early 1960s are going to the United Kingdom. So the idea of the United Kingdom being in a trading bloc and Ireland not being in a trading bloc is extraordinarily anathema to policymakers and political opinion formers in Ireland. It would be inconceivable that Ireland would have the clout, industrial, and like Ireland is mostly agricultural, as I said earlier. I mean, farming is, although it's dwindled over the course of the last half a century, is the main occupation. There is sort of rural depopulation over the decades, but that doesn't come in until Ireland is in the EEC. But anyway, they're keen to join if the British are joining. From the European perspective, it's all about the British application. The Irish application is welcomed, but it's kind of put to one side. The interesting thing is then de Gaulle, as we know, vetoes the British in early 1963. He doesn't veto the Irish application, but the Irish leave their application lapse, because the last thing, or maybe the second last thing, if it's bad enough us not being in a trading area with the British are, we certainly can't be in a trading area where the British are not, again, because of the simply the amount of trade that is between the two countries. We there's an agreement in 1965, an Anglo-Irish Free Trade Agreement, negotiated by the government of Lemass, Jack Lynch, as finance minister, Charlie Haughey as agricultural minister, and their civil servants. But we are tied up with the with how the British see Europe. And then from the European perspective, there Ireland is very, like, Ireland is really not terribly important. And while the British application is really important for the Irish, the British themselves really have no, they don't really care about the Irish application. I've seen minutes and records of various meetings in the between British and Irish governments in the 60s, and we're obsessed with the British, but they're barely considerate of us, really.
Right. And so just for the sake of, let me zoom out for a second, for the sake of perspective, I believe now, like today, Irish exports to the UK are maybe 12% of Irish exports.
Yeah, it might be a little more than that, but it's not very very much more than that. Yeah,
it's in the low teens, I think.
Yeah, oh, very much so. Like, it's under 20% certainly. And what has happened is as many people thought would happen, including people like Lemass, Whitaker, Haughey, and others, Gareth Fitzgerald, for instance, a great Europhile who became Fine Gael Taoiseach in the 1980s, they saw the fact that if we were in a trading group, it would give Indigenous Irish industry the opportunity to reach wider trading markets. And entrepreneurialism, if that's even a word, is not in the Irish cultural psyche in the 20th century. There are certainly some entrepreneurs, of course, but they are in protected industry. So to give one good example about protected industry, there was a Ford car plant in Cork City, not far from where I grew up, and people I knew, their fathers worked in Ford's. Now, Ford obviously wasn't Indigenous Irish, but they came to Ireland. Of course, Henry Ford himself, his grandfather was from Cork. They set up a plant, and it's protected. The Irish government gives it subsidies, and what happens is it ultimately closes down in the mid-1980s. There was a Dunlop's factory next door to it, again, which was protected, and they had subsidies, and they closed down in the mid-1980s. There's like significant unemployment, but it's because of the loosening of tariffs and the lowering of trade barriers. And while it's a big hit to the people of Cork and to policymakers, the view of many taking a wider perspective on these matters is that there are more opportunities than there would be collateral damage, I suppose one might say. And I mean, we now live in an era of full employment, give or take, and emigration still happens, but happens for different reasons, I think. So certainly European integration, when it does happen in the 1973, do you see, has changed, I think, the Irish kind of psyche around the economy. Now, that's not to say everything is, it's a land of milk and honey, because it certainly isn't. The 1980s are a grim decade, and we can talk about that. But I suppose just to end this section, Ian, by the time of De Gaulle goes in the late 1960s, there's a second application in 67. De Gaulle vetoes that for Britain. Ireland leaves its application lapse. And by the time De Gaulle is gone, Ireland, Britain, Denmark, and Norway all have another go. The Norwegians eventually decide not to go in, but in a referendum in 1972, Irish people overwhelmingly vote 83% to 17% to go into the EEC, and a new chapter begins.
Was that, just briefly about the 1972 referendum, was it surprising that the result was so overwhelming in favor of membership, because the political class was divided on the subject, weren't they?
Yeah. So the short answer is yes. Now, I wrote an article with Niamh Purcell years ago, well over a decade ago now, looking at public opinion. We'd come across some new public opinion polls in some private collection taken at the time. The government was certainly worried. And we called our article, "Is it a new allowance Irish entry to the EEC and polling or whatever. And that phrase, is it a no allowance, was a woman enters a post office and she's given a leaflet about the EEC by the postmaster or mistress, government issued leaflet, and she asked the postmistress, is it a no allowance? And there's very, the level of ignorance about the EEC in Ireland, notwithstanding that there had been a debate about going back a decade about entry, the level of ignorance is quite, quite high. And there was a fear amongst some of the two main political parties, Fianna Fáil, who are in power, and Fine Gael, the main opposition party, that apathy, ignorance would lead to a more committed no, the no vote, the no campaign being a bit more committed, and the potential rejection. Now, the trade union movement, which had been supporters in the early 60s, certainly by 72, advocates for a no vote. The Labour Party kind of sits on the fence. Some of its leading members come out, say, advocating a no vote as well. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the farmers' organisations and the business people, are all strongly in favour of a yes vote. But we can also say that most trade unionists actually voted yes, simply on the numbers, 83 to 17. The turnout's high, 70-odd percent, because it is a major decision. And there have been other referendums since the Constitution had been enacted in 1937, but nothing on this of this this major significance. So the no campaign is, I mean, in one way, it's a bit of a hodgepodge. It's like, oh, we wouldn't want to go into the EC because we'd have no control, echoing what happens in Britain over many years later. And then there are questions of colonialism, and that Ireland's history of being a colonized should put us with more oppressed states in Africa, Latin America, South America, etc. So there's a kind of there's a strong what we might today call far left opposition to the EEC, which has always existed in many European countries. But ultimately, the notwithstanding concerns, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael run a relatively robust campaign, and like most but not all European referendums in the subsequent years, I think the Irish people took a view it was better to be in than to be out. The 60s are a much better decade than the 50s. Unemployment goes up. Immigration continues, but it's at a much lower pace. I mean, we don't get immigration really into Ireland until the early 20th century in any great numbers. And it's overwhelmingly passed. And as I said, then a new chapter begins.
So that's so that brings us to 1973. So the 1st of January 1973 is actually the date when Ireland joins. So what were things like in Ireland at that time? And I mean, I asked before, like, what did Ireland need to do to prepare itself for EEC membership? And it sounds like that Ireland actually had to change its economic model in order to prepare. But also, like, there's a case of, I think that when Ireland joined, it almost immediately ran afoul of European rules about equal pay. And that was kind of a moment when Ireland had to adjust. And not just economically, but also socially. Am I right?
Yeah, you are. So, yes, Ireland does change its economic model. It's preparing, as I said, for a decade. Protectionism is weakened, and we try to prepare ourselves for free trade. About a couple of decades ago, Ken Whittaker, who lived until he was over 100, I interviewed him a few times in my researches over the years. There was a book of essays put together, and that was the title, From Protectionism to Free Trade. And he was very strongly of the view, look, that the Europeans, they're not going to worry about us. But if we want to be in this club, which we think could give us economic opportunities, we've got to play their game without expecting them to actually help us. So Ireland does start reducing its tariffs. It does start preparing for free trade. Now, there's a huge debate within the civil service and the Department of Industry and Commerce in particular, deeply worried about jobs and the loss of jobs in particular. What's Ireland like? Yeah, like Ireland is conservative socially, culturally. It's fond of banning things. So it's banned books for since the foundation of the Free State. And we have what sort of overseas listeners might think is a very odd thing. We have what's called a marriage bar. And the marriage bar worked in the civil service, and basically women who worked in the civil service, once they got married, they had to give up their employment. And now it sounds in 2023 like completely mad, completely bonkers. And in many ways, it was. And there was this sort, and even if one looks, there's a large debate in Ireland at the moment about the constitution and the role of women in the constitution. There's talk about changing the constitution because Eamon de Valera, who we mentioned earlier, who wrote the constitution was passed in 1937 with some of his civil servants. I mean, they're conservative Catholics. They're conservative in matters of sexual morality. They do believe strongly in the idea of the family, and that the best part, the way the family would best work, is if when people got married, that the woman spent her time at home raising children who would then contribute to society by the opening up of the economy. But also, it's not just the opening up of the economy, it's the opening up of air travel. Air travel is expensive, but people start going to Spain. They start going to Portugal. They start taking sun holidays. They're not as prevalent as they are now, but they certainly are beginning. Up to that, people only ever travel to Lourdes or to Rome. Lourdes to see the Grotto, and Rome, to see the Vatican, basically, and the Sistine Chapel and whatnot. But let's say people start going on their holidays in 2 weeks to Benidorm or to the south of Spain, or to the Algarve eventually, although that comes later. But it's an important cultural fix. And also Ireland had, as you mentioned, we had a scenario where men were paid more than women for doing the same job. Now, that still exists to a certain extent to this day, but that then quickly fell foul of EU rules that had to be changed. But Ireland's always looking for derogations, on a whole range of things, from equal pay to abortion, right up into into pretty much the current day. And that has become a theme, I think, of Irish membership of the EU. But certainly the role of women in Irish society, in my view, has been dramatically changed by membership of the EU, which forced policymakers not to think of women in a cultural context, but as equal parts of our society.
Right, that's very interesting. And there's, because one of the tales, of course, listeners will be familiar with the opening up liberalization of Irish society on issues like abortion, gay marriage, but going back to this time in the 1970s, and there are even questions about contraception and mm-hmm. divorce. These things were still illegal, and at the time there was a lot of worry that Ireland would be forced to become a more liberal country by the EU. And a lot of that was misplaced. A lot of that change came internally in Ireland. But this is one case where, in fact, the European Union or the European Economic Community forced Ireland to change its rules about women's equality.
Yeah, because, I mean, so a lot of those issues around which you just mentioned, divorce particularly, divorce is in the constitution. I mean, the prohibition of divorce is in the constitution. The reason we had a referendum in 1983 in Ireland to insert a prohibition on abortion was precisely because there were many people in the Irish body politic and in what we might call conservative interest groups, cultural interest groups, that if we didn't have a prohibition on abortion, the damned Europeans would make us introduce some sort of legislation. But at least if it was in the Constitution, they wouldn't be able to do that. Why were they worried about that? Because the European Union had forced Ireland to restructure its pay in relation to women. Now, there are also lots of women's interest groups, the Council of Status for Women in particular, who are pushing a more liberal agenda for women's rights. But yeah, you mentioned contraception. I mean, we don't have legal contraception. There's a famous case taken in the mid-1970s by a woman called Mary McGee, whose husband was a fisherman. He would be away at sea for weeks on end. He would come home. They would have sexual relations. She would get pregnant. And, you know, I think she had about 8 kids at one stage. And the doctor said, like, you'll have to literally stop having children because it's affecting your physical health. She went to the courts, which gave her a right of marital privacy. Legislation was introduced in the late 1970s by Charles Haughey, who was the then Minister for Health, known as an Irish solution to an Irish problem, which allowed for married couples on prescription from their doctor to obtain contraception. Now, again, you know, 40 years later, 35 years later, whatever, this seems extraordinarily quaint, but this caused a huge row. When there was a bill a few years earlier on the same issue, Liam Cosgrave, the Fine Gael Taoiseach, voted against his own party, which was introducing such legislation. And even though it was perhaps the most restrictive kind, there was still a very, very significant and vociferous debate. That abortion referendum is carried 2-1 in 1983, albeit on a low turnout of about 53%. But abortion then becomes a huge issue when the Supreme Court actually, close to a decade later, allows for very limited abortion after a terrible case, the so-called X case, where a 14-year-old child found herself pregnant as a result of a heinous rape. We won't go into the complications about that, but abortion has been, there was a codicil to the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, where Albert Reynolds, the Fianna Fáil Taoiseach, was able to negotiate an addendum basically to say nothing in this treaty will change Ireland's constitutional position on abortion. Now, that does change in 2018 because Irish social mores have changed and there was internal pressures. We had a same-sex marriage referendum in 2015, which was passed overwhelmingly, as was the repeal of the Eighth Amendment. But there's always this concern amongst cultural groups, and I'm a great believer in that political parties really do in one way reflect their citizenry. This is popular. Cultural conservatism is popular in Ireland. It's not as if somehow the elites were conspiring against a great mass of people who want the sexual licentiousness or whatever. You look at letters to in many sets of Gareth Fitzgerald's papers, Charles Haughey's papers, people are supportive of the of restrictions on abortion. There's a divorce referendum in 1986, which doesn't pass. One does pass in 1995 to remove the constitutional prohibition, but only by about 9,000 votes. The floodgates never really open. Divorce statistics in Ireland are, I think, low internationally, but certainly within the norm, where the fear was that, there would be Irish society would sort of collapse. But the European Union, they were certainly concerned that its large sort of tentacles, a bit like what's happened in Britain, although on an economic issue, that you would cede control. That really hasn't happened as we know. And there has been significant support for the EU and Ireland since its membership, with sort of serious declines every now and again, which we can discuss if you want.
So going back, thinking back to the way Ireland related to the European community when it first joined, would it be fair to characterize this kind of a transactional relationship?
Yeah, so what happens is, it's funny though, It often reminds me, although on a more serious level, of when the British booted out Churchill after the Second World War. So we have an election in 1973. Fianna Fáil are booted out. They've been in power since 1957. So we have a new Fine Gael Labour coalition. Gareth Fitzgerald is appointed the minister for was then called External Affairs, but Foreign Affairs. And to be fair to him, he's a passionate Europhile. He'd been writing columns in the Irish Times for the guts of a decade, advocating for entry to the EEC. He beefs up the Department of Foreign Affairs, and there is a special section dealing with the EEC. He tours European capitals. I mean, he's a one might even say a zealot, but he is a prominent proponent of the of European integration. But it proves popular in the early stages because, yeah, to use the word transactional, what happens is for decades Ireland becomes a net beneficiary of the European budget. We don't become a net contributor until into this century, and so we gain enormously from things like EU structural funds. If you look, we discussed the Maastricht Treaty earlier in terms of abortion, but the main issue in terms of Maastricht was Albert Reynolds had become Taoiseach in February of 1992. The Maastricht Treaty is still being sort of negotiated, and there's a summit, I think it's in Edinburgh, and it's a bit like peace in our time. Reynolds comes back saying that he had secured 8 billion pounds, Irish punts as they were then, in structural funds. Now the EU said it was, or the EEC said it was 6 billion, but nevertheless it was a large tranche of money, and you only would have to drive around this country to see how structural funds transformed our road network, for one. So yeah, there was a view commonly held, I think amongst the populace, that Ireland benefited financially and needed to. And to be fair to the Europeans, we did need. I mean, Ireland was, as I said earlier, poor agricultural country on the periphery. And structural funds, as you know, and many listeners would know, the idea is to boost the infrastructure. So places like South Wales and Britain, the North East, were seen as structural funds areas for beneficiary, and Ireland, we do benefit. Now, in the early 2000s, there is a little, we fall out of love a little bit with the EU. There are rejections of two treaties, Nice in 2000 and one,
Lisbon.
And Lisbon in 2008. Because we become net contributors, and maybe that's a very transactional way of looking at it. And Irish referenda on European integrations are desperate. They're desperate receptacles of falseness, because there's all sorts of things alleged by those on the no side. Oh, you know, your son will be, you know, transcripted into a European army, and there'll be abortion on demand, although that does come later, but it comes internally. It doesn't come from the European Union. We'll be joining NATO, a whole range of issues. And it's also not to say that the DEC is a panacea for all Ireland's ills, but of course it's not, because if you look at the 1980s, it's not quite the 1950s, three decades later, but unemployment re-emerges in the 1980s as a significant problem. Inflation is high, and emigration comes back with a desperate vengeance. I mean, if you look at something like the 1987 general election, that's fought overwhelmingly solely on the economy. Fianna Fáil in opposition relentlessly hammer the Labour Fine Gael government of Gareth Fitzgerald, although when Fianna Fáil do come back, they win the election, but they don't get an overall majority. They enact even more swinging cutbacks than Fine Gael were proposing. And it looked as if Ireland was back in the sort of economic doldrums, notwithstanding our European membership. But that changes in, again, the late 80s, early 90s, and into the mid 90s. And European integration The European Union is a strong element of that, because again, it's about conditions. It's about the macro economy, and in the late 80s, we start actively hawking for foreign direct investment into Ireland, and so Apple Computers comes to Cork, Dell comes to Limerick, Intel comes to Leixlip in Kildare, just on the outskirts of Dublin. There are a variety of reasons, but one including tax and tax support from the Irish government, including a relatively well educated population, but also because it's on the doorstep and a member of the European Union, giving easy access to these companies to sell their products in all across Western Europe and all across the Union.
Right. So you'd say that it's based more or less in the 1980s that Ireland kind of discovers its secret sauce, like this being able to welcome foreign direct investment, often tech giants from the United States, and they can have their European headquarters in Ireland due to tax advantages, but also, you know, all it's an English-speaking, well-educated population, et cetera, et cetera.
And it's in the European Union.
That's the key.
And the Americans had done this in the late 40s with the Marshall Plan, part of which, of course, was about rebuilding Europe, but also part of it was selling, you know, American fridges and televisions and the like to people who wanted to live a relatively normal lifestyle, where they would be able to watch television and have a proper fridge in the aftermath of the destruction of the Second World War. And in the 1980s, and certainly I have I've seen files in the Irish government records and letters to both Fitzgerald, Haughey, Reynolds about the efforts they are making personally to bring foreign investment into the countries. I would say membership of the European Union, certain tax advantages now, and that becomes a big issue later on. The French are, in terms of European corporation tax, which we've seen now become somewhat standardized, but wasn't up until very recently. The French were constantly complaining about Ireland's lower rate of corporate tax. Their response was, well, if you want to lower corporate tax yourself, go ahead. And that's been a kind of contentious issue. The English-speaking language, certainly, all of those things come to help and lead to a relatively boom in the economy. And foreign direct investment to this day is, you know, it's really, we've moved, Intel are still here, Apple are still here, both huge employers. But then we had the likes of Google and, you know, some of the social media companies, particularly Facebook, Twitter, or X, whatever the hell it's called now, has its European headquarters in Dublin. That has Ireland, I think one might say, has kept pace with the changing nature of tech and of American corporate needs.
You've been listening to Decades, made with the support of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative, although the views of the guests are entirely their own. The Post-Brexit Europe podcast is a product of the DCU Brexit Institute. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano. Thank you for listening.